It's now 16 October, and I'm continuing my interview with Maury Adamson. Maury, I understand you listened to the tapes of the last session. Anything you want to add or amend?
No, there are a couple of gaps there, but I think we're going to cover some of that today.
Good. Yes. Okay, well, where we left it last time, the next thing we were going to come to was your role with the Environment and Conservation Committee of the House of Representatives, which I understand was between 1975 and 1977.
That's right, yes.
Could you tell us a bit about your role there and about the committee itself and any special tasks they had while you were working with them?
With that committee, it was an environment and conservation committee. They had a number of tasks they wanted to get involved in. And during 1975 and up to 1977, when I completed my task with them, we tabled some five reports. The first one was dealt with the Softwood and Forestry Agreement Acts, and that involved not only taking evidence about the particular material, but inspections of softwood forests in places like the South Coast near Eden, in Victoria, and also in Queensland, in the area between north of Brisbane before you got to the Sunshine Coast. It was a fairly extensive inspection program facilitated by using RAF aircraft, including South Coast inspection, which originated here in Canberra at the airport. Also, the committee was very interested in national parks. The committee back in 1975 tabled a report on the impact of the state highway on the Black Butte Reserve near Newcastle. That report was tabled towards the end of 1974. It was an inquiry that generated quite a lot of interest from the Newcastle area because of the importance of the state highway going, which was proposed to go through what had been a fairly sacred area. After that, the committee looked at the trafficking of fauna in Australia. I wasn't particularly involved in that one myself. The staff at that time, I had a couple of research officers who undertook the minor tasks, the smaller inquiries, and took them through from almost the beginning of it to the advertisement of the inquiry in the newspaper, and the inspections and that sort of thing. The speaker to come, Dr. Jenkins, was very involved in those inquiries in particular, and that's where I first met him and became associated with him in a work sense. We set up a very close relationship in those days because he had a health problem and motor neurone disease, and he needed some assistance, physical assistance during that time, and it was a From my point of view, it was a delight to be able to help him. He was such a pleasant man.
Was he the chair of the committee?
No, he wasn't the chair. He might have been the chair during the 1975 period, but of course the election in the 11th of November 1975 saw the end of the Labor Party in government, and I think he also became associated with the committee in the new parliament after the election. As I said, we dealt with the question of trafficking in fauna. We also had a visit to Ayers Rock, Uluru as it now called, in 1976 and early 1977. We tabled a report on that in March of 1977. the management of the Ayers Rock Mount Olga National Park. And it was about at that time that I ceased my association with the committee. I went on long service leave anyway, and when I came back from leave, the role of senior parliamentary officer in charge of committees was being advertised internally, and I applied and was successful in getting that job. The one very interesting recollection I have of particularly of the tabling of the report on the land use pressures on areas of scenic amenity, the case study of Dandenong and Macedon Ranges in Victoria, that report and the inquiry, in fact, was chaired by one Tony Lamb, a member for one of the Northern Melbourne seats, a pharmacist. He subsequently lived in Canberra after he ceased his political career. But the interesting thing about it was that we attempted to table that report on the 11th of November 1975. The table office really wasn't of very much assistance to us that particular day. They said, "We're not sure when the House is going to sit." And I said, "Well, could I speak to the Speaker, please?" Gordon Sculls at the time. No, they said, "I think he's out at Government House." And whether he was or not, I don't know. But his leader, of course, was, and he was talking about being kicked out of government and so on. But it was a very interesting day. I spent quite a lot of time tramping the corridors here, trying to find the people who were, or a person who was going to ensure that the report was tabled. In the event, the House sat for a very short time at 2 o'clock, as I recall, not with the idea of receiving an Environment and Conservation Committee's report, but dealing with the dismissal of the Whitlam government, which was, of course, nation-rocking importance. In the event, the report was held over, and the new committee eventually tabled it in, believe in May of 1976 by the new Environment Conservation Committee, which was formed after the election.
An interesting question. When reports were tabled, did you attend the chamber?
Generally, I did. Yes, I'd either go into the public gallery and just watch the chairman. I would have prepared a statement for him. Sometimes, not always, to which if I had prepared a statement, he would probably add to it in a way that he personally would want to contribute. But I generally was there when the reports were tabled. Was every now and again there was a spare seat in the officers' seats, not far from the Speaker's chair on the government side. That was generally the way. And as soon as the report had been tabled, of course, we distributed copies of it to the press in the press gallery. But never before it was actually tabled.
Did you ever get approached while you were in the chamber by the chairman or someone else for advice while you actually were in the chamber yourself?
No, I can't recall that happening. No, generally the chairman was well briefed enough to know that about the report, they would have been involved in the preparation of it, and in the course of the inquiry they'd have been right across what was happening and the content of the report, they would be aware of that.
Were you present when there were substantive discussions about the contents of the report?
Well, no one would know about the content except the members. There might be debate at a subsequent time, but no, not really. It's on the tabling of it, very rarely would there be very much discussion. If there was a local member or a member whose electorate embraced the area being discussed in a report. He might well be aware of what was happening, and or maybe the Minister for Works or the Minister for the subject matter being discussed in the report might make a comment, but I really was never required to contribute to a chairman's knowledge of the content of the report while the report was being tabled.
Then in 1977, after you came back from long service leave, you then took up the new role of senior parliamentary officer. And you mentioned last time that you were responsible for supervising committee secretariats or secretaries for the House of Representatives committees. Is that right?
That's right, yes.
Yeah. What exactly was your role in terms of that? What did you do?
Well, I have a general supervisory role to when committee secretaries wanted help for one purpose or another, I'd have that role, but I'd be generally aware of what committees themselves were doing. We had a meeting of committee secretaries every Monday at which they reported progress on particular inquiries, matters which they believed that they needed some help or guidance on. That certainly, that Monday meeting was a very good guide to how various reports were coming, various inquiries were coming on, and whether the committee secretariats were having any difficulties. So I was there to ensure that they had sufficient staff. I had a role in interviewing staff when there were vacancies, and generally in reporting to the clerk assistant who was responsible for committees on what was happening. I also had a role in filling in as a committee secretary in the event that one of the committee's secretaries was absent for one reason or another. I did a little bit of travelling with the Road Safety Committee, for example. I also had a role in the administration, the secretariat administration of the Joint Standing Committee on the ACT, and that was an interesting one. There wasn't all that much work involved in it, but it met from time to time dealing with ACT matters. Some of them would involve an inquiry, otherwise they would be just catching up with the matters or progress of matters involving the ACT in Canberra. It was particularly interesting in the 1978-79 period because John Knight, the local senator who had been chairman, suddenly died, and his replacement as Senator Margaret Reid was appointed, and she, without any committee experience, became chairman of the committee, and she needed, with respect, a good deal of help in understanding what committees did and how they went about it, their work. I formed a very close and friendly relationship with Margaret. She was a delightful person to deal with, very competent, a lawyer. But whenever I see Margaret now, it's like our hometown week.
In your supervisory role, did you have any staffing resources that you could? You mentioned, for example, if a committee secretariat was in needed extra resources, did you have access to resources you could then allocate to that committee, or would you sort of try and negotiate with the other secretaries to borrow some of their staff?
Oh, there would be some movement of staff as required. We were never forced into a desperate situation. We generally knew if something was going to happen that required additional resources, one way or another. We really rarely had a crisis situation, I've got to say. We were located in the old Hotel Canberra at that time, of course, and generally at under my supervision in those days, there could have been up to half a dozen committees were fairly active. Some, for example, the Prices Committee, or which later became the Expenditure Committee, the Road Safety Committee, Environment Conservation, Aboriginal Affairs, Tourism, the ACT, and there are a couple of select committees dealing with particular matters referred to the Secretariat by the House, things like specific learning and family law. And then later on there was the new and permanent Parliament House Committee, which didn't come under my supervision, but it was created after the site for the new building was finally selected.
You were on the House of Representatives side. Did you have, in doing this period, I mean, did you have someone on the Senate side who had the same kind of responsibilities with whom you had any dealings?
Yes, well, it was one Arthur Higgins who filled a similar role in the Senate. He'd been an associate of mine in the National Capital Development Commission 15 years earlier than this. He had a very similar role. Some of the joint committees he had under his surveillance, but the Joint Standing Committee on the ACT was the only one that I was particularly concerned, the only joint committee that came under my surveillance. Yeah.
What was the relationship between your secretariat and his?
Oh, well, there was no relationship as such. We each went about our job in a similar way. We didn't really need to confer for work reasons. I knew Arthur Higgins very well. He was a very good family friend. And I suppose we talked generally about the way committees were working and what they were doing and the resources they needed, but there was never any conflict. There was really rarely any need to discuss matters with them.
So no sharing of resources or anything like that?
Oh, No, that didn't occur.
Okay, we're now moving in time. We're now up to 1983-84 when you became secretary of that subcommittee of the Joint Standing Committee on the new Parliament House to deal with what was going to happen to the Provisional Parliament House. How did that come about?
Well, if you go back a step, dealing with the time that perhaps that I was transferred to the Department of Administrative Services to deal with that special inquiry on the future role of the National Capital Development Commission. That arose because the department was approached by the Department of Administrative Services for help in finding a secretary to run the inquiry into that that matter that was referred, was set up by the federal government in 1982. It was, I suspect, the legislation under which it was established was the ACT Committee Inquiry or Inquiries Ordinance of 1938. I suspect that it was established by the Fraser government and particularly the Treasurer at the time, wondering about the long-term future of the National Capital Development Commission. It had been working since 1958, and I think perhaps as the Treasurer was a bit worried about the extent of the resources needed by the Commission to get on with its work, and they thought, well, maybe now's the time to inquire into its its long-term future. The inquiry is set up, and the Department of Administrative Services, by virtue of its function, was looking around for staff to man the and they approached the House of Reps, and I think Doug Blake, the clerk at the time, was aware that I'd had worked with the National Capital Development Commission in the early 60s, and maybe that might be an appropriate point to from which to appoint me.
You actually did cover this in some detail last time, if I remember.
Did I? Okay. Yes.
The certainly the outcome of the proceedings, you were very unhappy about. You mentioned that they were not adopted by the Parliament, and you thought that was a great loss for the ACT.
Yes. Well, you know, just very quickly, the secretariat was set up. The accommodation was found for us in Construction House, and that inquiry finished in July of 1983, when we reported to the Minister, Tom Urien, at the time. And so the inquiry having been finished, I came back to the department here, and there was the new and permanent Parliament House Committee was established in offices up on the site of the new building. This inquiry into the future of the old Parliament House arose from, I suspect, a matter which arose from a point raised by one of the members of the new and permanent Parliament House Committee. And as I was at a loose end, I set up an office in the offices on the building site, and the job was given to me to carry out the secretary's responsibilities.
Mm. Can you tell us about the work of that committee? That's obviously of considerable interest to us here in Old Parliament House.
Well, the committee itself was a committee of 8 or 10, a fairly large committee, jointly chaired by the Speaker and the President of the Senate. They appointed a subcommittee to deal with this matter of the old Parliament House. And both the Speaker and the President were members of the committee. Were 3 or 4 other members, so it was a fairly small committee. We advertised the matter in the local press and in the normal way, and we met on a couple of occasions. There were submissions received from the Department of Capital Territory, of course, the National Capital Development Commission, the Architects Institute, had a couple of trips away. First one was to have a look at the old Mint building in Sydney to see what use they had made in 1983 terms of the accommodation that was quite well set up and had a very historic background. It was a fairly short inquiry. I suspect the report might have been tabled early in 1984.
May 1984.
The submissions, the proposals which the committee looked at, there were 3 propositions put to the committee. The first it was that the building should be demolished to make way so that the visual scene in front of the new Parliament House wouldn't be obscured by an unnecessary building. The second proposal was that the building should be retained as it as it was at the time, and as it still is. And the third proposal was that the additions which had been made to the building post 1927 should be demolished and, in effect, to restore the building to its original shape and form. I was a bit concerned about that, and I had my own personal views. Though I suggested one day, one of the morning meetings it was, that the committee had, that it would be a good idea to have a look at the building with the construction behind it, going on behind it, from a distance. And I took them up to Mount Ainslie and down to the War Memorial. And it was quite evident, I think, to all of them then that the new building would be very nicely placed on the white base provided by the old building. If you took the old building away, your views of the new building would be fairly obscure. You really wouldn't see it in its proper form because it is rather blended into the environment, all the landscaping and so on. But as I think the committee generally themselves agreed that it would be a mistake to either abolish the building, to demolish the building, or to reduce it to its 1927 form. So in effect, that was the fairly quick conclusion that they reached, and all the other matters which were dealt with in terms of the management of the building and how it will be treated, and it's were dealt with as incidental to the main conclusion that they came to, that the building should remain in its present form.
I've heard some folklore that some of the considerations that were put for, suggestions that were put forward included turning Old Parliament House into a hotel, and in some cases, or into an artist's studio. Is that only folklore?
It is folklore, yeah. That neither of those propositions were ever put to the committee.
Mm.
I think in terms of it becoming a hotel, the Parliamentary Triangle in those days was, and has been ever since, in effect restricted to matter areas and buildings concerned with government one way or another. Yeah, such as the National Library and the High Court. And
there was one of the suggestions though before the committee, wasn't it, that this might end up as a conference centre to be used for one of our international organisations.
Oh yes, that's right. That's right. The I can't remember offhand the one that you're talking about, but yes, there was. But it was never thought that it would get a function which wasn't related to government in one sense or another.
One thing which I've heard said was that that you played an important role in defending Old Parliament House. Care to comment on that?
Yes, well, I suppose my role with the committee was pretty much along those lines.
In which way did you exert pressure or twist arms to get them to see it your way?
Well, I think the viewing of the old building from Mount Ainslie and from the War Memorial said all I would have needed to say in respect to the retention of it. But I pointed out to them that there was just an enormous amount of history involved in the building. You know, just go back to 1975, for example. You don't see David Smith standing on the front of a commercial building talking about sacking the Prime Minister. It's a government building, and it's a well-known government building. And it had a role to play in the future. It should be preserved. It was a heritage building, and that was a point, I think, which the committee quite easily came to understand and to accept.
And so those were views that you put to the committee in some form or another?
Yes, in some form or another. Yeah, committee secretaries needed to be fairly judicious in the way they expressed any views they had. Yes.
Well, the impression I've had is that in this particular committee, you played a fairly, perhaps a more active role than you might otherwise have done with other committees.
Oh, well, I was a very good friend of Harry Jenkins, and I knew Doug McClelland pretty well. I don't think I needed to make a statement other than just to express the views and say, oh, could you have a look at this point of view or that point of view? Yeah. Oh, no,
Was the committee's view unanimous in its reaching that conclusion?
Oh, yes, it was. The pity was that the Parliament, government accepted the point of view put by the committee in the report. The pity was that after the building was vacated in 1988, it was 3 or 4 years before it was opened and it was given some attention. It was badly in need of maintenance by the time it was opened.
So when you finished the work with this committee, was that when you moved on to become Senior Private Secretary to the Speaker?
Yes, it was. Yeah.
How did that come about?
Well, the Speaker had two private secretaries, his principal private secretary and the senior private secretary. The principal was Kerry Clancy, who dealt with his political and electorate matters. A senior position which had been occupied by John Ferguson, a retired naval officer, for quite some time. He looked after a Commonwealth Parliamentary Association matters and matters dealing with the administration of the House of Representatives Department and the other departments in Parliament for which he and the President had a joint responsibility. John Ferguson suddenly died in towards the middle of 1984, and or maybe a little bit earlier than that, but and the Speaker was looking around for someone to replace him, and it just fortuitously I was at a loose end, having finished the report on the old Parliament House, and I was offered the position as his senior private secretary. Of course, I knew Harry Jenkins well. I mean, I'd been associated with him at that time for over 10 years, or about 10 years. I was delighted to be able to be offered the job. Yes, a very easy man to work with, and we had a lot of mutual interests outside of parliamentary interests, and I was delighted to accept it.
Can you perhaps describe a bit more exactly what your job entailed?
Well, the Speaker was the ministerial head, if you like, for the administration of the House of Representatives Department, and jointly with the President for the Joint House Department, the Parliamentary Library, and the Hansard Parliamentary Reporting Staff. And my concerns were in dealing with matters about those departments which came for the Speaker's consideration one way or another. And that was really my responsibility. Also dealing with matters relating to the Commonwealth Parliamentary Association, in which the Speaker had a leading role in Australia. Yeah.
The management of the administration of the House of Representatives departments, that sounds like a fairly substantial task. Were there how many sections or areas did you actually have to look after or deal with?
Well, I was in effect three small departments, and each with their parliamentary departmental head, and there were matters dealing with the administration of those departments. Joint House, of course, dealt with the maintenance of of this building. Also, still in those days, they were responsible for the administration of, or it was responsible for the administration of the Public Works and the Public Accounts Committees. It was, in effect, the work of the permanent heads was brought to the Speaker in those days, which it needed decisions about various matters.